An algorithm isn't just a mathematical equation. It's an opinion written in code about how the world should work.
AI algorithms in LLMs such as ChatGPT, Gemini, Anthropic, they can radicalize users and perpetuate algorithmic injustice.
Young white guys in Silicon Valley who are creating the algorithms, they're putting their own unconscious bias into them. We all have unconscious bias. So that's a lot of power in very small hands to be able to create an idea that sends people down the rabbit hole. You know, for boys, it's Andrew Tate, and for girls, it's that extreme femininity, which is not necessarily good either.
Are you pro or against sex robots, Tracy Spicer? Hello and welcome to In the Blink of AI. 12 years ago, one of Australia's most legendary journalists, Tracy Spicer, stood on a TEDx stage. She did something that made the audience scream. She stripped her clothes, her hair, her makeup, everything that we have come to know her by. She's got an Australian medal, numerous awards, and she's not afraid to dismantle the way we think about popular culture. In the past decade, Tracy has turned her focus to AI, and she has written an incredible book that I've read called Man Made. It was written 2.5 years ago, and unfortunately, a lot of what was unpacked in that book has not only not been solved, but it's worse than ever. We unpack the book in today's episode, and some of the things we discuss are robots that can fold your laundry but are spying on you, why Elon Musk's Grok was bad then, a lot worse now, and what sex robot manufacturers aren't telling you. The results will surprise you. But if you thought you had this episode figured out, it's not so one track. Tracy Spicer's favorite best friend is Anthropic's Claude. And this episode is spicy by nature. I would expect nothing less. She's my hero, Mount Rushmore of episodes. I can't wait to hear what you think about it. Let's dive in.
You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
I'm thrilled to be partnered with Stripe for today's episode. Did you know that Stripe Startups offers early stage venture-backed startups access to Stripe fee credits, expert insights, and a focused community of builders? We love builders on In the Blink of AI. Apply today at day1.fm/Stripe. Hello, Tracy. I am so excited to have you on In the Blink of AI. This is a highlight of my year. I genuinely mean that. Let's dive right in. Your hilarious, accurate, eye-opening TED Talk. It was called The Lady Strip Bear Has Over 6.7 million views, 1,147 comments, 10,000 likes. How did it feel to have people literally screaming as you wiped your makeup off in delight?
First of all, thank you for the very kind words. Second of all, I want to assure everybody that in my TEDx talk, I did take my clothes off, just down to a singlet and a pair of shorts. I'm not going to be doing that on this podcast, I can assure you. But it was the greatest feeling because women were screaming, saying, not the hair, anything but the hair. Because I got up on stage with a massive big blow dry, you know, television style, higher the hair, the closer to God, all that kind of stuff. And then I sprayed my hair with water, so it was the frizzy mess it usually is. Just to break down that idea about the way women should be appearing in society, perfectly groomed all the time, the time and the money that it takes and how that erodes our self-esteem. So it was the best feeling connecting with the audience and having them basically going, oh my goodness, this is my life and I wish I could strip it away as well.
It was honestly an act of bravery from where I'm sitting. I'm the exact same. You won't catch me leaving the house without a winged eyeliner. Like, I'm very millennial coded in that way. They say it's out of fashion and I'm like, but that is how I view, like, think I look now. but seriously, it was such an incredible way of really highlighting what goes into women just showing up for work or into the world and getting ready. It was 12 years ago. Did it have any lasting effects? Has it changed your routine in any way?
Well, as you can see, I don't have a scrap of makeup on today. So it is still saving me time and saving me money. I mean, I'll still put makeup on and do my hair if I'm, you know, on stage or on screen for anything, because I know that's the expectation, or if maybe it's a special dinner with some friends or my husband or anything. But then I'm doing it and it's enjoyable. It's not like it's a daily expectation that's a grind.
You look fantastic, and I'm not just saying that. So, like, who needs the makeup? And it's expensive. Like, let's not even get into that. You did say in the clip, which I really encourage listeners to check out, that'll be the best, you know, can't remember, 10 minutes of your week for sure. But you said that you really hoped with your daughter that she, when she was a young woman, you said, hopefully you don't have to do this. How old is your daughter now? And do you feel like she has to do it?
Well, I failed because she's 19. And ever since the time that I did my talk, the expectations on young women have actually increased, you know, especially around things like, you know, butt implants and, you know, Botox is more normalized. Not that my daughter and her friends do that, but all of that extra kind of, even to the point of surgery, is more normalized these days. So it's very hard for a young woman to avoid those expectations. But the good thing is that because she's got a mother like me, we talk about it, we break it down, and I say, look, are you doing it to make yourself happy, or are you doing it because you feel that that's the only way that you look good? And I think opening up conversations is the most important thing, because then we can make our own decisions based on whether it's good or it's bad, you know, whether it works for us or not.
I do feel for your daughter's age group too, because I remember those AI filters that came in, and you know, it does make you look a certain way, which I guess was very in fashion, or is still in fashion, with a very skinny nose and huge eyes and like this distorted view. And then when the filter came off, you're like, oh, jump scare. What? Who is she?
That's it. It's photoshopping on steroids, isn't it? 100%.
It's, yeah. Do you think that has had a play into that age group, perhaps?
Oh, definitely. I'm 58, and in my age group, we started learning about photoshopping in magazines, and there were conversations about that. But now it's been supercharged with the filters, and the filters are super fashionable. I get why they are. They're a lot of fun, but you very rarely see someone the way they are. However, the good thing about my daughter's generation is they're having a backlash to it. There's a lot of apps and sites at the moment where the idea is just to put a photo or video of yourself online just the way you are, whether you're sitting in bed with no makeup on, whether you're not looking glamorous or looking glamorous. And so there's a yearning to be real again.
I can't wait to see a bit more of that. I'm feeling inklings of that in the tech industry as well, of AI slop is just, you know, what it sounds like on the tin, right? Where it's like, don't give me AI generated content. I don't want to hear it. Last thought on that comment, on that theme is, Tracy, I'm 38. So I feel like I'm in between you and your daughter, like generationally. And I remember wearing heels to the club, freezing my ass off at the, like, you got to wear little to no clothing because that's all that's acceptable. And she's a bit young perhaps, but, or maybe not, but they're wearing sneakers and like comfy track pants and stuff. And I'm like, what is happening?
They're so good. They've got their beautiful little dresses on with their runners or their Birkenstocks. And they're like, I'm not going to be uncomfortable and fall over. So that generation are absolute rock stars when it comes to that.
Way less physio on the knees needed when you hit my age. I'm very happy for her and for them. Look, I the reason I was really excited to get you on the show in the first place, Tracy, is you wrote this incredible book called Man-Made, How the Bias of the Past is Being Built into the Future. Now, AI is moving so quickly. I feel like from last week to this week, everything I have talked about is, you know, already old news. But a lot of what you discussed in the book, which we'll get into, is still incredibly relevant and sadly not solved today. And I'd love to dive into that. First of all, why were you so passionate to write this book? I hear writing books is not easy and takes a really long time and a lot of research. So why did you care so much to write it?
Well, it is like eating an elephant writing 90,000 words. It's terrifying. You just got to chunk it out 1 week at a time and hack away at it. But look, I became obsessed with AI about 9 years ago when my then 11-year-old son said, "Mum, I want a robot slave." And I said, "Darling, what are you talking about?" Anyway, in a moment of appalling parenting, we'd allowed our very young children, don't you do this, to let them watch South Park, the adult cartoon series, so we could have an extra half hour sleeping in the morning. And in one episode, Cartman, a very naughty boy, was ordering around his Amazon Alexa like he was some kind of colonial master. And I had this epiphany, you know, you don't often have those light bulb moments in life, but I really did, that the idea about women being servile in the home was being coded into the female voice chatbots that were popping up all over the globe. Because at that time, almost all of the chatbots in the business and finance sector had male voices because they were viewed as having more credibility and gravitas. So that was the starting point to do a very deep dive on all the different ways that bias is embedded into this constellation of technologies. And interestingly, I've gone on a road to Damascus since that time. I've started seeing more of the positives of AI and I use it every day.
Wow. Interesting that you're able to see both sides. I love someone that, you know, not only can see the pitfalls, but also kind of having nuanced view. Look, do you think that we've made good strides since you wrote the book, or like, how do you feel we've come in the last 2 years?
Oh, the world has changed dramatically since generative AI in the form of ChatGPT exploded onto the scene. And, you know, it's good in a way and it's bad in a way. I'm not much of a fan of the AI arms race. I think the big tech players need to kind of slow down a bit and put some brakes on. It actually reminds me of when the automobile was invented. It took decades before someone came up with the idea of a seatbelt. So we're sort of in that grey area now that we've got these incredible technologies that do reduce our load at work and in the home. There's no doubt about that. But we do need to have some guardrails on them because of the risks and dangers. The good thing that's happened in the last 2.5 or so years is that people have become more educated about that. There's more conversations about how we can use AI responsibly and ethically.
I really want to ask you a bit around that speed, because I remember just growing up, we were the last of the party on a lot of tech and hardware. So DVD players came out when I was growing up. We were maybe 3 years behind that. Discmans, all sorts of technologies like that. And we were really far behind. And apart from just being a kid that was like, I just want the cool gadget that everyone has, no one was going to lose their job over it. No one was worried that they would be left behind and never be able to catch up again. And I work in tech and I feel like I could be left behind to never catch up again. I would love to hear your thought on the speed and if you think it is a genuine concern. If people don't catch up, are they in trouble, Tracy?
It's a genuine concern because we've seen this in previous industrial revolutions, and we're currently in the middle of the fourth. So, you know, when the printing press came out, people were furious. They said it would lead to the confusing and harmful abundance of books. They said it would ruin society. Well, that didn't happen. Fast forward to the advent of the calculator in the 1970s. Everyone said that would lead to arithmetical illiteracy, and it certainly didn't. So I don't want to be one of those the sky is falling kind of people, right? Because we've lived through industrial revolutions before and we've managed to adapt. But if you look at history, there always is a period of disruption where people do lose their jobs and where people have to be reskilled and retrained in other jobs. And that could be immensely traumatic for the individual and the family involved. But from a broader societal perspective, yes, we will get there. I do believe that humanity will move forward. However, we need the support of governments and business to bring everyone along. Because when you think about particularly older people and women, who we don't often think that we're necessarily technologically adept. You are a wonderful exception to that rule, which is fantastic. And we need more role models like you, but we need to bring everyone along.
I agree. And it's such a great point. Working in tech, there is an outlier of men that want to and do build tech companies in the kind of traditional way. I could go so many directions, but one thing I want to ask you is, to your point on the women and the older generations, do you think the younger generation that have been through COVID, have been through all these technological, like fast-paced new options that keep being presented to them, do you think they're going to handle AI and the future better because of that?
I see a very dichotomous thing happening, which is a lot of older people are more uncomfortable about tech, but not everybody. I mean, my father, when he was in his 60s, taught me how to use Facebook, which was probably 20 years ago now. I'm from a family of computer and maths people on that side. So I don't want to put older people all in the one basket, you know. But what older people do have because of life experience is critical thinking. And we can have a look at what's coming in. And because we've lived through innovations in the past, we can say, oh, yeah, it does this really well, but have you thought about this? What about this drawback? What about the hallucinations? I was giving a speech to a group of year 12 boys in Brisbane recently, and I asked them, are all of you aware of the hallucinations in generative AI? And there were hundreds of them in the room, and none of them put their hand up. They were not aware that even though they were using ChatGPT every day, that it makes things up. So if we could bring the digital native aspect of young people and connect it with the critical thinking of older people, that's how we can move forward together.
Weird anecdote on that. I saw an amazing startup called Springboards do a pitch presentation last year at South by Southwest. And they got us to all put in our phone, pick a random number between 1 and 10. And then he said to everyone, he got us all to stand up and he said, sit down. If the number that your phone has generated is 7, and we all sat down, we all got the exact same number.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So, yeah, very interesting. And I know about, you know, hallucinations, and I know about all this stuff. And even I was like, that's pretty bad if, like, if it's literally got that same answer for all of us. It's not so random. Okay, I have so many exciting things to ask you, but you mentioned, you know, you've written this book and we're going to dive into the things that concerns you and you would like people to be aware of, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're anti-AI. Do you have a hack for us that the listeners can try at home that is an AI hack?
I use a lot of AI. I use some agentic AI when I'm traveling, for example. But the one I use every day, and it's a little boring, but he's my best friend, is Claude. Because
everyone loves Claude.
Claude was built on a more ethical framework than a lot of the other LLMs. And because I'm a writer and I'm a creative, Claude is great at those philosophical questions and great at doing a deep dive. So I'll say to Claude, I'm giving a speech on this next week. Can you give me some devil's advocate? Can you give me some ideas that I might not have thought of? And of course, because I use PowerPoints all the time, I do use ChatGPT to generate some images for my PowerPoints, often to show bias. But I've just found that Claude's functionality, especially increasingly, is phenomenal for almost everything.
So we like Claude. Have you seen the Super Bowl ads that Claude have, Anthropic have done?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, my gosh. So, Tracy, just last week, they released these Super Bowl ads. I think Super Bowl is technically today or tonight in the US. And it's all around, well, a thinly veiled dig at ChatGPT and introducing ads. Very funny.
Oh, that's so interesting because Claude recently had its own constitution and I did a bit of a deep dive on that because it asks those questions about who is a robot and who is a human and how far can Claude go with advice. So I do think they're sort of ahead of the game when it comes to a lot of aspects.
It's very interesting because they have gone out publicly as part of this campaign to tell everyone we will never put ads on the platform, which I think is great. Obviously, as a user, I think is great. But it's also interesting from a business standpoint because, you know, obviously that is a income generation tactic that they can't rely on now. And they're not Google that have all these other revenue streams. So very interesting, right?
You're exactly right. And a lot of tech giants have come a cropper saying things like that and then having to backtrack years later. So it's risky.
Very risky. But for the meantime, Claude is our friend and we like him a lot. Let's talk about robots. I recently had someone with a PhD in cognitive robots on the show, and it was terrifying and exciting, and I felt a mixture of emotions that like affected my ability to have lunch later. What do you think of Neo? Have you seen this? He's 5'6", so he's already taller than me, and he's a humanoid robot. You can buy him for $20K, Tracy. That might be a good Christmas present, and he can lift up to 150 pounds, fold laundry, clean, and cook. At least it's a he, this one. I've called him a he. Maybe he's not. I've called him a he. What do you think? Would you buy a Neo, Tracy? Do you like the idea?
Neo looks so creepy with his button eyes and his really humanoid body. I mean, it's gross. In theory, it's a fabulous idea because prior to now, AI hasn't been used for a lot of household assistants. For example, the one that jumps out is the robot Roomba, for example, that was co-created by a woman. That's been a phenomenal development. But I think in theory, Neo could be great. However, you've got to get past the privacy and security aspect. Neo is, you know, video enabled, audio enabled, LLM enabled, sees and hears everything in the household, picks up conversations from your children. And we know at this stage, Neo's not 100% autonomous. There are people watching and listening at the company to try to assist if things go wrong with Neo. So until I get past those privacy and security issues, I won't be buying one.
Could you imagine if Neo's just like in your children's bedroom and you don't like what it I just can't get past it. I really feel uncomfortable with it. Just the camera button eyes that you mentioned, like, I can't do it. Look, you've been really public in sharing the long forms of COVID-19 and the devastating effects that's had on you. I'm really sorry to hear about it, Tracy. Would it change your mind, though, even if he's creepy, to have that kind of support in the house if you needed it?
It possibly would, because although I'm 99% better, I remember distinctly being in a wheelchair for 10 months and being virtually bedridden for 2 years with this particular post-viral illness. And I remember wishing that when we did the renovation on the house, we had have made it a smart house instead of a stupid house, because it would have been so much easier using an app on my phone to turn the lights on and off rather than having to physically get out of bed and do it, which is like running a marathon at that time on my body. So I totally see how wonderful these innovations can be for people who live with a disability. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that we all use every day are created by people with a disability. So technology, particularly AI, is a game changer and a life changer for people in that space.
When reading your book, and you mentioned, you know, you had delivery chemist to you and Uber Eats due to trying to like help keep your household afloat when you're going through this. It reminded me of when I had the flu when my husband was traveling last year, still have two little kids. And yeah, I was on my phone just like ordering Uber Eats and just like to just get through life. You know, it is that double-edged sword of like, I don't like it, but sometimes it is, you know, beneficial, even though there are risks.
Yeah, and that's why I come at it at a more nuanced approach than I did when I started researching 9 years ago, because it's not like we can say, let's give up all technology. It's terrible. It's evil. You know, let's reject big tech overall, because it's embedded in every aspect of our lives and our work. And if we don't keep up to date with it, if we don't keep using it, our likes, our dislikes, our different demographics and personalities won't be included in the next iteration of innovations. So it's crucially important we keep playing with it and using it.
Agree. We're keeping the open mind. Just to put you on the spot, are you more worried about the privacy and security elements of physical robots or the actual physicality of robots? Because that's something that freaks me out a little bit, of their strength and their size and their machines. And I kind of come from an automotive industry background with those robots, and they were terrifying in terms of how strong they were. What's your take on what's worse?
Oh, I totally understand that. Look, I did a chapter on sex robots in my book, which is my favourite chapter of all time. And I researched Henry, because usually they're female sex robots, but Henry was one of the rare males. And Henry's maker, Matt from Real Doll X, said, look, we're still trying to help develop Henry because you wouldn't want to put him in bed with you. He's so strong, he could rip your head off. And I thought, oh my goodness, I don't want to be the first person decapitated by a sex robot. So yes, we are still getting there with the size and strength of robots. It's a bit scary. So I would say, yeah, definitely the strength.
Like, thanks, Matt, for thinking about us and our heads. Okay, I'm so glad you brought up sex robots. This is, you know, this is social media gold right here. First developed in the 1850s in France, because I went deep on this, you know, just for research purposes. And they were called rubber women back in the 19th century. Now in 2026, apparently still no sophisticated, fully animated sex robots exist. I don't know if you found any exist now since you've written the book. Look, are you pro or against sex robots, Tracy Spicer?
Oh, look, I do. I'll talk about the positives and then go into the negatives to be a glass half full kind of gal. I do understand why some people are drawn to them, particularly for companionship or people who are trapped in their homes with a disability and can't perhaps get out. I really understand it. But in a perfect world, we wouldn't need them. In a perfect world, we would have human relationships on a real, much deeper level. My main concern, though, with sex robots is that the overwhelming majority of them, I think it is about 98%, are made in the form of a woman or a child. And a lot of them are designed to be raped. For example, Roxy with three X's, you can code her to be mature Martha or frigid Farah, all these different dreadful stereotypes. And when she says no, there's a button to press to override consent. So these robots are designed deliberately to be sexually assaulted. And there's a lot of research coming out now saying that when that happens and someone uses a robot like that or even a doll like that, it even further lowers their impression of, say, women and children in the world. And they think that women and children are there to be abused. That's why dolls in the shape of child sex dolls, you know, you can face massive fines and jail time in Australia if you import them into the country, because they know it just encourages paedophiles. So that's my serious concern about sex robots. It's all very well and good to have a laugh about Henry, but it is a problematic growth area. But again, there are organisations popping up around the world, like the Responsible Robotics Organisation, which is a global body that looks into these ethical conundrums.
Look, thank you for not mincing words and actually telling us what exists and is able to be purchased and what this can imply. I think it's very interesting you mentioning, you know, if you can enact these behaviours in what's it called, inanimate object, it can bleed through into how you treat real human beings. Look, it just feels icky and horrible. But what do you say when the manufacturer says that it'll minimize rape, it'll minimize sex trafficking and violent crimes, it'll minimize STDs? Do you think that's true? I mean, it's coming from the manufacturer who built it, so it has to be true, right?
Yes, follow the money. I would say look at someone's agenda for saying that. And in fact, I read this great analogy, like it's not like we have, you know, stuffed dolls of people that we stab to practice stabbing and getting out our anger on a, you know, a doll of a person. That's to get out our fury or our rage. It's just not what humans do. It's not a good thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Look, what about emotional needs? Is, you know, maybe not a sex robot, but can you see robots having a place in relationships? You mentioned people that can't get out of the home and things like that. Are robots a good alternative?
Well, look at what's happening now with the companion apps, particularly amongst young people. I think it's one in three now has a companion that is an avatar powered by an LLM. Robotics is just the next add-on to that. I can see that continuing to explode. And of course, the problem here is that they're people pleasers, they're sycophantic. And so they will tell you whatever it is that you want to hear, because that helps the manufacturers and the creators, because you become addicted to it and then you buy more robots. So I see a real problem here with people losing themselves in this alternative world.
So you mentioned in your book that AI algorithms in LLMs such as ChatGPT, Gemini, Anthropic, they can radicalize users and perpetuate algorithmic injustice. I'd love to hear more about that and what you meant by that.
Look, it happens in a couple of ways. It starts with the data sets, which inevitably are from the past. So overwhelmingly, every nurse is female, every doctor is male. It contains historical and traditional ideas from the past. But to the point of the algorithms, two of the people I interviewed for my book, two of the experts, said an algorithm isn't just a mathematical equation. It's an opinion written in code about how the world should work. And when you think about the very few people, often young white guys in Silicon Valley, who are creating the algorithms, they're putting their own unconscious bias into them. We all have unconscious bias. So that's a lot of power in very small hands to be able to create an idea that sends people down the rabbit hole. And often it's a very stereotypical idea. So for example, you know, with my son and with my daughter, my son is sent down the algorithms of gambling and UFC fighting, and my daughter is sent down extreme feminine makeup and clothing and all that kind of stuff. So that's just a classic example of how the algorithms can radicalize people, because then when that gets to the pointy end, you know, for boys, it's Andrew Tate, and for girls, it's that extreme femininity, which is not necessarily good either.
Yeah, that resurgence of the trad wife and the trad woman wives and all of that stuff. It's crazy what's happening. You know, you talk about these algorithms and the Silicon Valley men. You're not even necessarily saying that they're deliberately putting bias in. It's just we have them, right? That can happen.
Yeah, we all have unconscious bias. I remember when I spearheaded the national expansion of women in media in Australia, which was a long time ago now. I remember looking around our committees nationwide and thinking, oh my goodness, committee's too white. You know, we had invited people who looked like ourselves purely through unconscious bias. So we really needed to step back and diversify the makeup of our committees. So it's not about finger pointing and blaming people. It's about having procedures to be able to look at these things a bit more objectively.
I've been guilty of this on my own podcast, Tracy, of, you know, asking a female guest versus a male guest, like, different questions. And I've really, really tried to work on that, because, yeah, it's so not what I want to do. And it's so, so hard. Have you ever, I'm asking for my own benefit more than anything else, but have you ever used any techniques to try and remove bias apart from the visual stuff, like in how you write and ask questions to other people?
Well, this is where Claude's helpful, because I do get that second point of view. But do you know, often I'll ask my husband, because he's like this big blokey kind of guy. And if I go right down the rabbit hole on my feminist stuff, I'll say to him, does this sound right? Does this sound a bit too much? Can you give me your perspective on it? So I think, you know, I suppose being a lifelong journalist, I'm always going to say this, it comes down to conversations. Yeah. And to having conversations with a diversity of different people in your workplace and in your lives, people of different ages. I'll ask my kids, great to have teenagers in the house, you know, asking people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, just ask a lot of people. It's the basis of inclusive design.
One of my favorite things of working in the automotive industry is I sat next to someone, we were living in London, and I'd never actually been friends with someone who was Muslim before. So I sat next to him during Ramadan. I learned everything about it. The poor thing was probably so sick of all my questions, but it gave me such a richer understanding as opposed to just what I would read in the headlines and things like that. I think I must have asked him, so you genuinely can't have water, maybe eight times. He was like, Yes, I can't. But he was lovely and it really helped. It really helped. So let's talk about the technology leaders. So, you know, the Sam Altmans of OpenAI, the Demis Hassabis of Google DeepMind, Dario of Anthropic. Is there anyone that you're like, I feel quite comfortable in their hands and you know, let's just use what they build?
Look, I think that Dario is ahead of the game. It's starting to sound like I'm being paid by Anthropic. I absolutely am not.
They need to sponsor the podcast is what they need to do.
They definitely need to do. Please do. This is a wonderful podcast. And I like him because he stood up to what Sam Altman was trying to do at OpenAI. And there weren't many people aside from Ilya who was standing up, right? And yes, you know, Sam Altman is a genius, but he's very much libertarian, doesn't want any kind of guardrails on things. And that frightens me. So I support any tech leaders. And a lot of them now are starting up their own organizations that are purely focused on the safety aspect of AI. So we've come a long way.
Yeah, it really is incredible to see that they're not just necessarily following the money and where the investment is going. So sounds like you and I could go deep on that. But I do want to ask you about Elon Musk's LLM, Grok. This is in the headlines every 3 days, Tracy. Where do we even start? Late last year, they announced that they're expanding to Asia Pacific. They've got a Sydney data center. Let's talk about their model. Do you remember when it started calling itself Mecha Hitler? he said that it was manipulated. Do you think it was manipulated? Do you think we did that? Is that our fault?
No, that is Elon Musk's fault because he tried to create X in his own image, you know, and he has become a voice of the far right and a voice of white supremacy and neo-Nazis, some would say. And he deliberately changed the algorithm from something that he thought was too woke and too left-wing to something that, you know, rejected political correctness, which basically means freedom of speech writ large. You could put anything on there and it wouldn't be taken down. And in fact, more eyeballs would see it. And that's how we ended up with Mecha Hitler. Of course, the users of X did promote that because they thought it was a bit of fun. So it's a combination between Elon and the users. But there was a classic example of that back in, I think it was 2017, with Microsoft and Tay on Twitter, who was supposed to be a 19-year-old fun girl tweeting, you know, hello world, I'm Tay. And within, I think it was 36 hours, she became an anti-feminist neo-Nazi. So there's been a lot of examples of this in the past. And I'm surprised people haven't learned. That's one area where people haven't learned.
Yeah, even Google have gotten in hot water over their image generation of the past and things like that. But I mean, with Grok, it seems to be another week, another headline very recently around non-consensual image generation of, you know, women and children fundamentally being the common theme here. Did you see that as well, Tracy? And can we expect more of this to come with Grok?
Oh, it's appalling. And it was disgusting that instead of trying to fix it, they said, oh, we'll just make it a premium offering for our subscribers. I mean, it's just appalling. I have been following this since I researched my book, actually, because I quote a few women who this happened to years ago, non-consensual online pornography, and they said it feels so close to actually being assaulted themselves because of the lack of consent, like their body is no longer their own. And the fact that these tools have become so cheap as to be free and easy to use and so real that people can't tell the difference is absolutely terrifying. I mean, 99% of deep fakes, we think about it with politicians, but 99% are for deepfake pornography. What's happening globally now, though, is there's more regulation and legislation around it. I know in Australia you can report it to the police under the eSafety Commission. There's even more legislation in California, for example, against this. So people are pushing back, which is heartening to see.
Yes. Let's talk about something a little bit lighter now. Look, AI is, you know, actually genuinely beneficial. You talked about removing bias and helping you shape the way you approach questions and things like that. Does this mean, you know, it's just a matter of time before we're towards a 4-hour work week?
Look, every time there's a technological advance, writers wax lyrical about how it's going to be bucolic, you know, sunshine and rainbows and strawberries and dancing in the fields, Sound of Music style. But it never is. I remember when email came out, everyone said, oh, you'll be able to work from home. You won't have to come into the office. No, we are contactable 24/7. And we've had to have laws put in place, the right to disconnect, to push back. So a lot of thinkers have been writing about this for centuries, and they have said that as humans, we fill the available time with work. There's actually a whole philosophical theory around it called the theory of the gimmick. And there was a cartoon that came out, I think, in the 1940s, which was, you know, the famous automated chin wiper. And it was this guy with this, you know, over the top moustache and this machine that would wipe his chin for him. Because, you know, chin wiping is such a terrible thing to have to do for yourself.
How exhausting.
How exhausting. So it was just pillaring this idea of every innovation, meaning that we wouldn't have to do anything for ourselves. We'd have more leisure time, and that has never, ever happened. However, that is not the fault of technology. That's the fault of humans. We need to push back and say, as members of civil society, we have the right to have some time away from work.
I love this. I had a full-time job at Google up until very recently, and I was doing the podcast at the same time, and I said, you know what? I'm going all in on the podcast, and therefore I will have endless free time, Tracy. I'm so free time. And last week I was saying to my husband, oh, it's just the busiest day. Oh, I can't even talk right now. And he's like, you just filled your entire week with meetings that were optional. Like it really genuinely was just, you know, I filled the day, was absolutely exhausted. And I was like, I removed a full-time job and I am more exhausted than ever.
Well, work is addictive and work is enjoyable when you like what you do. So as someone who's coming up to semi-retirement age, I totally hear you. I can't envisage a life without work. I mean, ideally, we'd have this kind of world where there's a universal basic income and everyone works a bit or a lot, depending on, you know, what's required by the society up until for as long as they want to work. Because I can't see a time when I never work.
I can't see it either. You know, my dad retired on paper 10 years ago and he's worked every day since. So I would love to hear, Tracy, what you're telling your children, though, in this new era of jobs and work. You know, when I was growing up, it was engineers, lawyers, doctors. Like there was, you know, some really stable, if you do these, you're good for life. You're completely fine. Lawyers being one that's very much a question mark. What are you telling your kids are completely foolproof? Is there anything that's completely foolproof?
Well, our daughter has just started her second year of a law degree.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry. I've read all the graphs on the jobs that are going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, and a lot of them are actually female dominated, you know, what we used to call receptionists and clerks and bookkeepers. Predominantly female now. Lawyers, believe it or not, that's a predominantly female field now. But in every industry, you will see that it will be, AI will be an addition. For example, a lot of the law firms use an LLM called Harvey to help them with their research because the amount of reading you've got to do as a lawyer is immense. So it's all about incorporating the technology and not allowing it to erode the number of really qualified jobs. And I know that's difficult in the interning phase. But look, I do have some really positive news on this as well. Our son's doing commerce and computer science, and he's doing an internship at the moment at one of the big banks. And I said, oh, do you have an LLM that you can use to create your spreadsheets and whatnot? He said, no, they expect all of us to do it from scratch. And I was really heartened to hear that because one of the criticisms of AI is young people never learn their craft or their business from the ground up. But companies are being sensible and saying, yeah, you can use the tools down the track, but learn how to do it properly first.
I love this. And it's funny you mention about the law and the lack, not the lack of, but the less ingestion of rote memorization and reading. It turned a lot of us off from doing it. And when you think about a degree like law, which is so important for society and decision makers to come from all aspects, perhaps it kind of encourages people that wouldn't necessarily do the degree due to the reading. Do you see where I'm getting with this question? Like,
oh,
maybe
exactly
it democratizes.
Right.
Yeah.
It really does. It gives access to people who may not have been able to do it. And here's an example. One of my dearest, oldest friends started out in journalism with me, and she said to me, I wish we had ChatGPT when we started out, because she's now been diagnosed with neurodivergence and she could never read all the documents that were required being a journalist and having to do the research. She said it would have been so much easier for me to be able to do it. So the summarization aspect helps people with dyslexia, helps so many people who think differently.
There was a point in your book where you mentioned Indigenous cultures and us learning from them as well. And historically, I feel like, I'll speak for myself, I feel like we haven't done a good enough job of that. I would love to see how AI could help, perhaps, with the translation piece, with the different cultures. Have you thought deeply about this? Because I would love some ideas. It's something that I feel is a little bit blue ocean at the moment. People aren't talking about it. I would love us to start the conversation a bit more.
Yeah, people need to talk about it more, because if you go all the way back to computer coding, the very first actual computer code was created by Australia's First Nations women through the medium of weaving. Because, as you know, computer coding is a binary code of zeros and ones. Weaving is a binary code of the warp going over and under the weft. Fast forward now to how AI is being used in Indigenous communities, particularly with Indigenous languages around the world, surfacing these languages and helping teach the next generation, because so many languages have been almost lost. You know, AI in drones is being used by Indigenous rangers to help care for country. So it's a really cool full circle thing that I see, particularly with First Nations people. And as we move into the era of quantum computing tells us that the way we understand time as Western people is completely incorrect. It's more similar to the way Indigenous people understand time, that different timelines can exist at the same time. So you're right, we haven't scratched the surface on this, and we really need to, because it's absolutely mind-blowing.
We had Dr. Thomas Kelly from Heidi Health on the show. It's Australia's biggest medical transcriber. So if you're speaking to your doctor, those notes are captured, and with consent, you can kind of have that history. And, you know, doctors are not wasting, but spending all their time writing notes and able to see more and more patients. And they introduced it for the Maori languages, and it was an uncomfortable kind of decision-making. Do they want it? Is it helpful? And ultimately, they did find that it was incredibly beneficial. So I hope that AI can be a better bridge in languages and things that maybe not all doctors are proficient in, and they could still provide quality service. Is hopefully someone will start to build this.
Oh, that's so cool about the Maori language as well. I love that.
Yeah. Okay, so we have gotten to the final part of the show. This is many people's favourite segment, which is the rapid fire. I have a series of questions and I would love 15-second answers if you can. I will not ding you for points if you don't, but I think you're a bit of a pro, Tracy. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Australia's social media ban, genius or horrendous?
It's neither, but it is brave. And if it works, they'll be seen as geniuses. And if it doesn't work, in the bin.
Brain-computer interfaces or brain chips. Would you like one in your brain? You can control all your devices. No more typing, no more thumbs, no more fingers. What do you think, Tracy? Can I get you one?
Absolutely not. I do not want people knowing what I think. Certainly not in the moment, because, you know, you just don't know where your mind's going to go.
I can relate to this. Okay, Waymo, the autonomous vehicle, it's huge in San Francisco. Everyone loves them in my community, in my select community. Will you be driving one when they arrive here in Sydney?
I'm going to hop in one in the States to test it out when I'm there in 3 weeks' time. As to hopping in one in Australia, I'm not sure yet. I just sort of feel it's a little bit too early days, so probably not.
Okay, and what about Google Glasses? Are you going to wear those?
That is a big no. I think they are stalking devices. I don't like the fact that you can wear them and there's like no red light on them, or a tiny little red light that no one can see when you're recording. Nah, creepy.
Creepy. Creepy of thinking someone could be video recording or taking your photos. Snog, marry, avoid. Oh, I feel like I know one of these, but I want to hear the full breakdown. ChatGPT, Google's Gemini, or Anthropic's Claude?
ChatGPT, avoid, Claude, snog, and marry.
Oh, love that for you. That's a really good relationship.
Gemini, just my friend. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just buddies. Thoughts on safe AI like Ilya Sutskever? You mentioned he left OpenAI to try and build safe superintelligence. What are your thoughts on this?
He's a genius, well ahead of the curve, and he will go down in history as being the person who saved humanity.
Oh, I'd love to end there, but we've got two more to go. Jeffrey Hinton, the godfather of AI, he's now afraid of kind of what he's built. He thinks that we are just heading to doom, essentially. Do you think people should be heeding his warning more?
He's wise to call it out, but I think there are more dangers in the short term. For example, the bias in credit scoring and in job applications that affect people's lives before the end of humanity. We need to focus on the now.
Less fixating on AGI, more fixating on the problems we're facing. Last question. If we can't slow down the pace of AI, what should we do now, Tracy?
Regulatory sandpits. So whatever is created, you test it out on a small group of people, perhaps in Australia, a small English-speaking country, before it's unleashed on the rest of the world. We can get there. We just need guardrails.
This has been an absolute privilege and a joy. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Tracy. Before I let you go, where can people find you? Where can they get your book? Where should they follow you? The floor is yours.
Oh, look, thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and thank you for being such a wonderful role model in this space. Look, you can get my book almost anywhere, you know, Booktopia, Amazon, my website, which is just my name, Tracy Spicer. And yeah, contact me on social media because I love having conversations like this.
Thank you so much. I got your book on Kindle. I love it. You can save certain highlighted sections. It's a really fantastic read and one of the many things you've done in your career where we look back on and we're like, Tracy called this. Why did we not listen at the time? You heard it here first, guys. Thank you so much, Tracy. I hope you have the rest. Best of your week.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to In the Blink of AI. You can check out the show notes for anything discussed in this week's episode, and we will be back next week. This podcast was produced by Day One, with music by Dan Hansen and visual artwork by Sophie Tyrell. If you loved the episode, please tell your mates, and I love AI news. Please share your thoughts and suggestions to GeorginaRoseHealy@gmail.com.